Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back, everyone. Before we hear from our speaker, Jim Wilson, who is the former abbot of Choikyi Zen Center. I'm getting better at saying that. Choikyi. Find out what that means. Choikyi. It's our custom to introduce ourselves. My name is Vince.
Joe.
George.
Cass.
Kay.
Mark.
John.
Doug.
Howard.
Lena.
Jack.
Will.
Mark.
Paul.
Chris.
Carl.
Flint.
John.
Nicholas.
Greg.
Richard.
Lewis.
Kevin.
Lee.
Larry.
Michael.
David.
Roy.
Peter.
Jim.
Gary.
Mary.
Susan.
Bob.
Raphael.
Steve.
Bob.
Could I have some more light? The other way. Thank you. Happy New Year, everybody. So today I'd like to talk about the deathless. Okay. So the unborn, the undying. So I thought it would be a good topic to start the new year. the Buddha, there's a lot of teachings that the Buddha taught, but one of the ultimate teaching that he taught was that there exists that which is deathless and unborn. All the other teachings lead up to that. You know, they all lead up to that realization. There's a wonderful passage often quoted from the Udana. It's in the... it's from the Itivutaka. This was said by the Buddha. There is, bhikkhus, a not born, a not brought to being, a not made, a not conditioned. If, bhikkhus, there were no not born, not brought to being, not made, not made, not conditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, brought to being, made, conditioned. But since there is a not born, not brought to being, a not made, a not conditioned, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, brought to being, made, and conditioned. So that's a wonderful passage. You know, I have my little library here. There's a passage from the middle-length discourses. So, the not born, the not made. There are a lot of names the Buddha gave to this ultimate reality or ultimate nature: nirvana, the deathless, the unborn, the undying. So, what is it that the Buddha meant by that term? And he's actually, at various points, he's surprisingly clear about just what he meant by that. So here's the statement that he says to Ananda. Ananda, this is the deathless, the liberation of mind through not clinging. Very clear. So, Ananda, this is the deathless, the liberation of the mind through not clinging. So that's, let me put it to you, give you a little context. So Ananda is speaking to the Buddha, and Ananda says to the Buddha, "Venerable sir, here a bhikkhu is practicing thus. If it were not, it would not be mine. it will not be, and so it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. So there's a monk who's using that as a practice. So Ananda says, thus he obtains equanimity. Venerable sir, does such a monk attain nirvana? So nirvana is another name for the deathless. And the Buddha responds, one bhikkhu here, or one monk here, Ananda, might attain nirvana, but another monk here will not attain nirvana. So Ananda is puzzled and says, what is the cause and reason, venerable sir, why one monk here might attain nirvana, while another monk here might not attain nirvana? The Buddha responds, here, Ananda, a monk is practicing thus. If it were not, it would not be mine, it will not be, and so it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he attains equanimity. He delights in that equanimity, welcomes it, and remains holding on to it. As he does so, his consciousness becomes dependent upon it and clings to it. A monk, Ananda, who is affected by clinging, does not attain nirvana. So equanimity arises in one's consciousness through this kind of contemplation, and that's really nifty. That's cool, so I'm going to stay there. And it's precisely that gesture of trying to fix one's state of consciousness which gives rise to suffering, and the whole mass of clinging follows from that. But, venerable sir, when that bhikkhu clings, what does he cling to? That's Ananda asking the Buddha a question. And the Buddha responds, to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So that's a very high meditative state. When that bhikkhu clings, venerable sir, it seems to me that he's clinging to the best object of clinging. That's Ananda. So the Buddha responds, when that bhikkhu clings, Ananda, he does cling to the best object of clinging, for this is the best object, namely the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is practicing thus, if it were mine, if it were not, it would not be mine, it will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to me, that I am abandoning, thus he obtains equanimity. He does not delight in that equanimity. He does not welcome it or remain holding to it. Since he does not do so, his consciousness does not become dependent upon it. He does not cling to it. A bhikkhu, Ananda, who is without clinging, attains nirvana. So then Ananda responds, it is wonderful, venerable sir, it is marvelous. The Blessed One indeed has explained to us the crossing of the flood of suffering. But venerable sir, what is noble liberation? So Ananda gets the argument, but then he's saying, what is it that you're referring to? And then the Buddha responds, Ananda, this is the deathless, the liberation of mind through non-clinging. So it's a wonderful discourse. It's very clear. It's really wonderful teaching. So there's another discourse, and I forgot to bring the book, so I'll just have to tell you by memory where a disciple of the Buddha by the name of Anuruddha is speaking to another disciple of the Buddha by the name of Shariputra. And Anuruddha has been going through several types of meditative programs, and he's reporting to Shariputra that even though he has gone very far in these meditations, he does not feel that he has attained awakening. And he mentions three kinds of practices. which are kinds of concentration practices. Really. And Shariputra responds to Aniruddha, it would be better for you if you would put all of those aside and simply contemplate the deathless element. So just drop all that and contemplate the deathless element. So Aniruddha agrees to do so, and after contemplating the deathless element, he becomes one of the arhats, or one of the awakened ones. You know, like, so it's a very nice discourse. It's very brief. But, so the centrality of the deathless in the Dharma is referred to over and over again. You know, like, and one of the wonderful things about understanding this is that everything in the Dharma falls into place once you have an understanding of the deathless, the unborn, nirvana. You might simply refer to it as the eternal. You know, like, all the other practices are seen as supporting that awakening. You know, there's a distinction that is made in Buddhism between ultimate teaching and provisional teaching. Ultimate teaching and provisional teaching. So an ultimate teaching is a teaching regarding nirvana, the deathless, the unborn, the undying. Provisional teachings are teachings which lead up to that. Provisional does not mean trivial or discardable, which some people hear that and they go, that's how they interpret it. That isn't what it means. An analogy would be like if you say you hear the music of Miles Davis or Bach, and so you really want to become a musician because you want to play like that, you know. And so you go to a teacher and they say, well, first you have to hold your hands this way and you have to learn your scales. So of course the purpose of studying is not to play scales. You know, like, so the scales are a provisional teaching. Okay? You know, like, but it's not something that you can just toss aside, you know, like, you know, on your way to being a musician like Miles Davis, which would be really cool. You know, so that's the relationship between, you know, provisional and ultimate. You know, like, but it's not always clear to people. People forget what the ultimate teaching of the Buddha is, and they get lost in provisional teachings, or they get stuck, not lost, they get stuck in provisional teachings. So it's important to remember, you know, like, or to bring to one's mind what is the relationship between all these different teachings? You know, what do they ultimately lead to? There's a wonderful example of this Zen master Ban Ke. He's one of my favorites. He lived in the 17th century. And all he taught was the unborn. That's all he taught. He didn't teach anything else. Whenever he taught, he's very funny because he's very egotistical. he'll say things like, no one in the history of the world has understood the unborn as clearly as I. I mean, it's charming. You know, like, it's very charming. Like, or he'll say to his audience, you are very fortunate because I understand the unborn very clearly. You know, like, but just to read one passage from his teaching, what I call the unborn is the Buddha mind. This Buddha mind is unborn, with a marvelous virtue of illuminative wisdom. In the unborn, all things fall right into place and remain in perfect harmony. When everything you do is done according to the unborn, the eye that sees others as they are opens in you, and you know in your own mind that everyone you see is a living Buddha. That's neat. So there's I like the particularly Ban Ke because it shows that there's a wonderful continuity in the tradition. You know, like what I've been reading is from the Pali Canon, which is a very ancient strata of Buddha's teachings. And Bankei is in the 17th century, and it's wonderful to see that continuity. Like, in the Lotus Sutra, the teaching of the unborn and the deathless is very, very prominent in the Lotus Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra also makes that connection between when you awaken to the deathless and the unborn, then you see that all beings will become Buddhas. All beings have this Buddha nature. You know, like so. So that, and that is a wonderful basis for the cultivation of compassion and the blossoming of that compassionate heart, you know, within one. So that ultimate insight is what opens one's heart to the interconnectedness of all things. Well, I'll pause now. Are there any questions on what I've said so far?
You know, when you hear those terms of deathless and unborn, they can seem enigmatic or mysterious. But they're very, also aren't they very functional terms, very clear terms. That which we, you know, our bodies are apparently, you know, incarnated into this world pretty fully. And yet, that which never came into this world, or that doesn't come in physical form, or somehow permeates our conscious awareness of this world, and then leaves, is deathless, is unborn, it, you know, has a free relationship with our body mind.
It's sort of both. It's very subtle and somewhat mysterious, and it's also in a sense very obvious in this sense. Something which is deathless and unborn is eternal. The Buddha was very shy of using the word eternal. It's used very rarely in the discourses. You know, like, instead he'll use words like the deathless, the unborn, the undying, nirvana. And I think the reason he was shy about using the word eternal was at the time that he was teaching, that term had a certain meaning that he wanted to avoid. And what I'm going to get into in a moment is the Buddha's view about where the deathless lies, where is the deathless domain. And one of the what he was teaching regarding that was very different from what other people were teaching regarding that at the time. And so his specific understanding of what that term means is what I'd like to go into, you know, like now, you know, like it's really quite remarkable. I mean, just to go ahead a little bit, at the time the Buddha was teaching, the idea, the most widespread idea of what the deathless meant would be a celestial realm. You know, so, in other words, going to heaven. and the Buddha taught that celestial realms are impermanent and deities are impermanent. So that's not where the deathless lies. You know, like, and when you go through the discourses, one of the reasons the Buddha emphasizes the teaching of impermanence so much is that there's a very strong tendency to think that something which is impermanent is actually permanent and the deathless. And so he was very persistent at attempting to correct that misunderstanding. Like, but there are lots of candidates that various spiritual teachers offer for the deathless. The deathless is very attractive. Why is it very attractive? It's because it feels really good. It gives you a sense of serenity, calm, peace, you know, joy. I personally think that everyone has spontaneous experiences of the deathless and the unborn. You know, like, and you can recognize these spontaneous experiences through that bodily feeling of settled serenity or equanimity that appears spontaneously. Most people, however, do not recognize the profundity of what has happened and attribute that experience to a mood. So part of what the Buddha is trying to accomplish when he's presenting these teachings about the deathless is so that you will recognize the experience when it appears. You know, like so that you won't just attribute it to a passing mood. You'll say, "Oh, that's what he means. Now I get it." You know, like now I understand what he's referring to. There are a number of obstacles to the realization or awakening to the deathless, or I like to call it the presence of eternity, but whatever term you want to use, you know, like. The most significant obstacle to this is cynicism. Like, that's the biggest obstacle. In the discourses, occasionally the Buddha bumps into somebody who is completely cynical about the deathless, and he's very funny about the response. But these people have a surprisingly modern ring to them. You know, like when you read about them, you know, like. There is no liberation. There is no cessation of suffering. When we die, the elements disperse. And that's it. though occasionally that view appears in the discourses, my sense is that it was not very common in the Buddha's day. It is quite common in our day. There are whole schools of analysis which reconfigure any talk of transcendence, reconfigure any talk of liberation as a trick to seduce, as a power play, or as a, that the motive for this kind of discourse is actually to gain political power or money, or to manipulate others, or for psychological domination. Postmodernism is filled with this kind of stuff, and it's very sophisticated. Not only that, we all know of really good examples of spiritual hucksterism. You know, like, and so you can back up this cynicism with real good evidence. You know, like, so you know, given all of that. That's a serious obstacle, you know. Like, and this is where faith comes in. You know, like, faith is not blind faith. You know, like, I think I mentioned this before, but Sharon Salzberg's new book, titled Faith, is an excellent, superb introduction to the meaning of faith within a Buddhist context, because she's keenly aware of our present Western cultural situation, you know, like, and how reluctant we are to move into that domain. One of the real problems is that we've allowed ourselves, we have acquiesced in letting the fundamentalists define the meaning of faith, you know, like, and they have shriveled the meaning of faith. You know, it was a very rich concept. For example, if you read St. Augustine, you know, like, his conception of faith is very wide, very rich, and it was not blind faith. You know, like, that was not his conception. You know, like, or, you know, like, insisting on believing what is obviously absurd. You know, like, but the fundamentalists have shriveled this. I mean, it's almost, you know, like this dead plant, you know, like under their searing gaze, you know, like so. That, like, but faith basically in a Buddhist context means trust and a little bit of what I would call expectation, you know, like. Expectation in the sense that this practice will pan out. Expectation in the sense that that this will bear fruit. You know, like in the same way that if I'm a musician and I'm learning my scales, my expectation is that learning that scale will result in something, you know, like that I really want to do. You know, like I may not be able to see that right away, and in fact there may be years of frustration, you know, like about, you know, like I'd really like to be playing something that's interesting, you know, like rather than this stuff. But you know, the teacher assures me that all of this will be useful, you know, like for so that's the expectation part I'm talking about. Trust is that's taking refuge. You know, like trust is taking refuge. The Buddha is a reliable source. All these people who are telling me about are a reliable source. You know, like, and so I can trust the tradition, you know, like. But at the beginning, there does need to be a certain amount of trust, of leaning on the tradition, just as one has that same kind of trust when one begins any kind of endeavor. You know, like, so that's, we really need to broaden our understanding of what faith means, you know, like, in a sense, you know, like. And then when we enter into the practices and we actually catch glimpses of this peace and serenity, then that trust blossoms into, oh, I understand what they mean now, you know, and that element of leaning on someone or just, you know, taking it for granted falls away, you know, because the practice bears fruit. You know? Another obstacle to awakening to the deathless is being distracted by the provisional, you know, like so, or getting stuck in a provisional teaching, because there are many, many teachings in the Dharma, and a lot of them are really, really nifty. You know, like, so, higher dhyanic states, spacious awareness, the ability, you know, like, to concentration, ritual expertise in some schools, you know, that kind of thing. Certain kinds of practices produce certain kinds of ecstasy that is very attractive. There's, Roshi Kennett described how she was a Soto Zen master, how at one point in her career she was in this, in her practice, she was in this very, very serene and still place, you know, like the mind had really, really settled, you know, like really just like this lake without the slightest ripple on it, you know, like, and it was just wonderful. So she had gotten to a point where she could just like go there, you know, like, and her teacher told her very much along the lines of that discourse I read. He says, "You gotta let that go." like this too, you know, like that's it's a wonderful place, but it's a conditioned place. You know, like it's not the unconditioned. It's brought about through certain kinds of meditative practice, body posture, breathing, you know, and concentration. All those conditions being present, that stillness arises. You know, like which she did. She did let it go. But it's very many of the higher meditative states are extremely seductive. And never mind the higher states. Just you know, just doing a little better every day is can be very attractive, but that's what I call getting stuck in the provisional. You know, like, especially since it's not all that clear what the deathless is. You know, like, I mean, that's the difference between the deathless and becoming a great musician. You know, like, if I want to play like Miles Davis, I have a clear idea of my end goal. You know, like that. But awakening to the deathless is a little vague, you know, like, I mean, you know, like, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to get me a raise, you know, like, so. You know, given that, it's completely understandable how people get stuck in the provisional, but that needs to be released, you know. And the third obstacle is a lack of clarity about what I call the location of the deathless, you know, like, or just where it is, and this What I want to talk about now is how the Buddha construed the deathless and the unborn, where it is. And one way of approaching it is by contrasting the Buddha's view with other views, particularly views that were contemporary at his time. You know, like as I mentioned before, one of the most widespread view at the time the Buddha was teaching was that the deathless was a celestial domain, or one could become deathless by engaging in certain practices, and then you'd be reborn as a deity yourself. You know, like, and so Brahmanic rituals were designed to do that. You know, like if you did the rituals correctly, and you were of the right caste, the result would be that you would be reborn in a celestial domain, and you would become a deity of some sort. You know, like, and then you would be immortal. Did you have a question?
Would faith lead you to the place where you would consider ordinary reality and nirvana the same?
I didn't hear.
Would faith lead you eventually to the position that ordinary reality and nirvana, you know, non-duality?
Nirvana is samsara and samsara is nirvana. I am going to get to that. Can I wait on that question until I come to that? Because that's one of the things about the Buddha's view of the deathless, which was different. You know, like than the deathless domain. To go ahead is not somewhere else. You know, like so. Right. It's not, well, it's, Zen does emphasize that, but it's not only Zen, you know, like, so. What's interesting about the Buddha's approach to this is that when people offered candidates for the deathless, he was very strong about rejecting them. You know, like, he said, no. He said, deities are mortal. Deities are subject to karma. So, that means, you know, like, what does that mean? That means that, you know, angels and God will, Yahweh is subject to karma. Whoa! You know, like, so the big one in the sky is going to, you know, one day pass away. Not only that, he said the celestial domains themselves are conditioned phenomena. Being conditioned phenomena, they are impermanent. Now, deities live a very, very long time, and they, generally speaking, have a good time. but not always. Think Greek gods. You know, like, so, you know, like, so they had a rough life. You know, like, so, but they will pass away. You know, like, so that was the Buddha's analysis and response. Another prominent view at the time the Buddha taught was that of the Jains and the Jain teacher Mahavira. And Mahavira's view was that immortality lies in the soul. Yeah. So, and the soul is kind of a little homunculus, you know, like that goes on and gets reborn. You know, like, and if you understand that view, you understand the Buddha's teaching of no soul or anatman more clearly. He was doing the same to this teaching that he was doing to the idea that the deathless lies in some in becoming a deity. You know, like he was. What the Buddha was rejecting was the idea that there exists an independently existing soul, and that independently existing soul is immortal. His rejection of that idea was based on his primal realization of the interdependence of all phenomena. You know, like, he wasn't rejecting an interior life, he wasn't rejecting an interior consciousness, but that interior life and interior consciousness does not exist separately. You know, like,
Could the Jain viewpoint be similar to the Christian viewpoint?
It's much more extreme. Much more extreme in its dualism.
Which one is the more extreme?
Jain. Yeah, the Jain. Oh, yeah. So,
well, this is pretty extreme.
Well, I mean, there's a range of Christian views, but the Jain view is that the soul is immortal. The material world is transient. The material world is karma. Okay. To the degree that you're attached to the material world, you're locked in samsara. Okay, so the idea of spiritual practice in the Jain tradition is to free yourself completely from the material world. You know, like, from a Jain perspective, strictly speaking, there's no such thing as good karma. It's all bad. So anybody want to sign up? But the reason this was a prominent view at the Buddha's time is because Mahavira, the great Jain teacher, was a contemporary of the Buddha's. You know, like, and they lived in the same small area, so their communities crossed paths quite a bit. So it was a view. It was a view that the Buddha dealt with quite often in the discourses. You know, like some of the discourses become very clear when you realize that among the Buddha's prominent disciples, a large number of them were ex-Jains. Like, and so he had to clarify certain things. So like when he teaches on Atman, what he's saying to them, I'm not teaching what Mahavira taught. Like, it's a code word, what I'm teaching is different. So there are other views about the deathless. And in the West, the dominant view in the West is a dualistic view, that there exists that which is uncreated, and that's God, and there is that which is created and dependent upon. So Augustine was extremely eloquent about this. The Buddha's view would reject that. That first of all, he didn't believe that existence was created. In numerous discourses, he says there is no discernible beginning to samsara. No discernible end. It's just so that there's no creator deity which is interesting. There is no creation myth in Buddhism as a consequence of that. That's a contrast with the Western views. So here you have the Buddha systematically rejecting all these candidates that are being offered for the deathless, and yet also arguing that the deathless and the unborn and the undying exists. So where is it? Okay. So in order for something to be deathless and unborn, it has to have three characteristics. Okay, so this is Jim in his analytical mode. Bear with me. So the first characteristic is that it has to exist. I call it every when. That is all the time. Or always. So what is it that always exists and that never does not exist? The second characteristic is that in order for something to be deathless, it needs to exist everywhere. Every when, then everywhere. Okay? From the Buddha's perspective, every time someone suggested that the deathless was some other domain, he rejected that idea. Okay. The reason I say that it has to exist everywhere is that you can't have a when without a where. Yeah. Time is not the vessel in which things happen. Time is the unfolding of things, itself. Okay. So if you have something that exists every when, it has to also exist everywhere. That which exists every when and everywhere must also manifest in everything. Okay. And that is where you find the deathless. that which fits those three characteristics. So, here's the difficulty. In order for something to exist all the time, everywhere, and everything, it must be present in all visual phenomena. It must be present in all sonic phenomena. It must be present in all everything you smell, everything you touch, everything you taste, because it is always existing. Okay. So what is it that all those things have in common? That's the difficulty. See? If it is present in all visual things and all sonic things, it can't be a sound itself. Otherwise, it wouldn't be present in visual things. Okay? If it's present in all visual and sonic things, it can't itself be a visual thing, because then it wouldn't be present in sounds. So that's what makes it difficult, even though it exists everywhere. You know, like, it's precisely because it exists everywhere and all the time that it makes it difficult for us to see. The key to comprehending the Buddha's view of the deathless and the unborn is dependent origination. Okay? That which qualifies all existing things, that which all things have in common, is elucidated by the Buddha in his teaching of dependent origination. See? Now, I want to make it clear that when I talk about dependent origination, I'm talking about the general view of dependent origination. I'm not talking about the 12 links of the arising of suffering. Okay? So there's a confusion between the two. The view of dependent origination is clearly stated by the Buddha when he says, when this exists, that appears. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not appear. With the cessation of this, that ceases. That's the general view. If you apply that view to suffering, you get the 12 links of the origin of suffering. If you apply that view to bread, you get flour, salt, sugar, a bread pan, and all like that. But I'm not talking about any specific link. I'm talking about the quality of being dependent itself. See, that quality. Like so. In the Lotus Sutra, it says, all the Buddhas, the best of humans, know that all phenomena are forever without substance, and that the Buddha mind emerges through dependent origination. Okay? So the Heart Sutra says, all things are marked by emptiness. All things are marked by emptiness. That is, all things are qualified by this ultimate reality. So the color green can qualify visual things, and the quality loud can qualify sonic things, and the quality sweet can qualify things we eat. Okay. What is it that qualifies every single existing thing without exception? Okay. Dependent origination is the key to comprehending what it is that qualifies all things. Understanding that, the deathless emerges. One more step is necessary, and that's to actually perceive the deathless and the undying. Most of the Buddhist practices are designed to eventually allow you to do that. You know, like, and like I said, I think people spontaneously have that experience. You know, like, it's And in order to perceive the deathless, it requires a shift of attention. So normally our attention is fixed on the fact that this room is red and white, or the fact that the music is loud or soft. You know, like, those are what I call circumstantial qualities. Circumstantial because they arise due to particular circumstances and are confined to a particular sensory dimension, you know, like the dimension of sight or the dimension of sound. So what we need to do is shift our attention so that that quality that transcends any particular experience emerges. So it's actually possible to perceive emptiness. You can perceive emptiness. So like, you can, in the same way that you can perceive loudness, sweetness, or the, you know, the fact that the wall is white, you can perceive dependent origination. Now, I'm using dependent origination and emptiness as convertible terms, as synonyms, you know, like indicating the same reality.
Yeah, I think the Heart Sutra sums up very nicely when it says, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. They're both simultaneously dependent on each other.
Right.
Emptiness is form, simultaneously as form. So
right.
And to answer Snake's question, I think that the answer is no. Faith won't bring you to the realization of the unborn. Practice will. The shift of attention. You said you need to practice. This is a tool that will get you there.
Perhaps I'll give a talk about faith. One moment of a number of the discourses say that one moment of faith, complete trust in the presence of eternity, will open that reality to you. And I think that's true. But I don't think that negates, in a sense, faith can be a form of practice. But once you have a glimpse, once you have a glimpse of that deathless and the unborn, you know, like, then the Dharma really makes sense. You know, like, then, like I say, all the other practices, you know, like, you begin to understand. It's like, take for example, Buddhist ethics. So Buddhist ethics, very basic teaching, five precepts. You know, like, if your mind is agitated and completely distracted by, you know, plots for thievery or vengeance and stuff like that, your mind is completely wrapped up in the circumstantial. You'll never get settled enough to have a glimpse of the presence of eternity. Like, so there's the connection. So there's the connection, you see. Or take the practices having to do with concentration. You know, like, if the mind is wandering and zinging here and there, if it's not settled, the mind needs to be able to concentrate in order for that shift of attention to be accomplished. You know, like so. Or take spacious awareness, you know, which is the favored practice in Zen and Dzogchen. You know, like, so spacious awareness literally gives the space in the mind for that shift of attention to be accomplished. You know, like, if the mind is constricted and tight, its focus is too narrow to perceive that which all things have in common, that which all things are marked by. See, this was the Buddha's great insight, and that is that the divine domain is not over there. Like, that the presence of eternity is everywhere and available for everyone, all sentient beings, to awaken to at any moment. So you don't have to be the member of a particular caste in order to get access to the divine domain. You know, like, incidentally, this is one of the things that's very consistent. I've observed this in the history of Buddhism. Those who really awaken to the presence of the unborn, all of the secondary considerations fall away. You know, like, throughout Buddhist history, there's been this ongoing discussion of whether or not women could become enlightened. You know, like, it's from the very beginning, there was a kind of a tug of war about that. Bon K is very funny about that. You know, like he says, you know, like I'm talking about the unborn, you know, and the undying. You know, like the unborn nature, undying nature, same for everybody. You know, like and then he proves it. You know, like he goes to his audience. He goes, "Did you hear that crow?" You know, like, and they said, "Yes." He says, "Well, that crow is the same for me as it was for you, as it was for a woman, as it was for a man. Not different." See, so that's his demonstration. You see that that's his proof. You know, like that the unborn is the same, and that any being can awaken to it. So once you have that clear, you know, like then things like caste, race, sex, gender, you know, economic status, all of that becomes, you know, completely irrelevant. You know, like the part of the Buddha's, one of the Buddha's great gifts was that realization that because all things are marked by emptiness, because all Buddhas perceive that all phenomena are forever without substance, without exception, that awakening is accessible to all sentient beings without exception. You know, like, so that's why we practice, and that was the Buddha's great gift. And so I hope that we will all soon awaken to the presence of eternity and save all sentient beings from suffering. Thank you. I have more to say about this.
I hope we can revisit that, because it's a fascinating subject.
For eternity.
Yeah. And hopefully we can come back to that. Is there anyone that's new here today, so we can welcome you? Hi, my name is
John.
John, welcome.
And I'm Roy.
And Roy. And what's your name?
Michael.
Michael? Oh, exactly. I'd like to introduce you all to our gracious host, Greg. So if you have any questions about the group and so forth, you can see Greg. And even for people who are not new, you can see Greg with any questions. I don't know of any announcements. Are there any?
Yes. Talks are available on the internet at the GBF website, gaybuddhist.org.
And this will be the last announcement, for at least until next fall, from me about Dana and supporting your Sangha. So along with the final contributions, because this is sort of ending and we don't want to have a perpetual campaign, this is a card which just arrived from Melvin Puss, of a lovely painting of a Thai boat on it. And it came with a substantial contribution of significantly above the $100 or so average that we get from people. And if there are any contributions that are lower than that, of course. And he writes, "Dear Michael, Ellen," and he's from North Carolina, "Dear Michael, Ellen G., Jack, David, George, Lee, Paul, and fellow GBF leaders, words cannot express my deepest gratitude for the incredible job you do for all of us gay Buddhists. I have a profound sense of appreciation for the role GBF has had in my life. From living in rural North Carolina through living part-time in Thailand, I carry you, my brothers, with me. I love the connection through the wonderful newsletter to the groups. Thank you. Love and blessings, Nolan Tufts." So I wanted to read that to people, particularly those who are mentioned, and also to tell you that there are contribution forms next to the Dana Bowl and the food, which will disappear after this. So if you feel inclined to contribute and you haven't done so yet, please do.
For any of the new people, there's a sign-up sheet out on the table. If you'd like to give us your name and email, and we'll get you the newsletter.
Also, there's a nice Christmas card from our Sangha member Robert Newmont in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, if anyone would like to see his card. And there was talk last week of having a movie party this afternoon to see the two 2 p.m. showing of Andrei Rublev, which is the caster.
Is that the name of the movie? What is it?
The name of the movie. I have the info on it.
Okay.
What's it about?
Is it an epic? It's what about Bruce? About the great Russian Triffitch painter. And it's an extraordinary recreation of late medieval Russia. It's episodic and sometimes incomprehensible, but it is absolutely unforgettable. The greatest epiphany I've ever seen in my life.
And this one says, one of the most overwhelming visual achievements ever committed to film, Andrei Rublev, the man of the Soviet Union for years. Tchaikovsky's eight-faceted jewel extrapolates from the life of an obscure 4th-century iconographer to speak for the whole of artistic experience, belief, and redemption.
I think, yes, one more announcement. I'm the coordinator of hosts, of which Greg is our host today, and we have a couple of openings, so if people are interested in volunteering, it's a position that occurs once every 2 months for one Sunday. Please see me afterwards.
Are there some host announcements?
You invited to Donna, or that
parents,
they were all mentioned. Oh, were there her?
Okay, maybe I didn't hear about the Donna. Okay, my mistake.
No, while we're on this subject, we'd like to thank everybody who made contributions to fundraising. I think we did rather well, and we're very grateful to keep it coming. in terms of the Donna Bowl, I think our fundraiser is pretty much over for the most part.
Except for this is the last one that at least it gets mentioned here.
I guess more specifically, we do ask that people donate $5 if they're able to.
Yeah, more if you can.
More if you can.
We're part of the world of form as well as emptiness, so we need the money.
And the Donna Bowl for us.
May all sentient existence be well and happy. May all sentient existence be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May good fortune fill all the days of all the lives of all sentient existence. May all sentient existence dwell forever in the limitless realm of the ever-present peaceful heart and serene mind. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.